Now we're going to open our Bibles today to Deuteronomy chapter 22. And I recall thinking as I was preparing this lesson, how am I ever going to find the words to explain the profound and far-reaching impact of these laws of God to modern-day believers? See, this is one of those places in the Bible that is akin to a major highway intersection because an awful lot comes together. We have spent now going on 4 years starting at the book of Genesis to where we are now. 4 years. A long road has been traveled. Much understanding has been developed. So perhaps now we can talk about some of the more challenging underlying concepts that spread out and engulf sections of the Torah that we've already studied. We're going to be a couple of weeks in Deuteronomy chapter 22. Now, my challenge in teaching Torah has always been just how many layers to peel of that onion to peel back at any given moment before enough's enough and it's kind of time to move on. This chapter especially presents me with that challenge. But in the study of this chapter, we also have another challenge: how to deal with the contents of this part of Moses' sermon in a way that isn't so offensive to our Western sensibilities that our ears just close down to it. Because at the molten core of this chapter and much more of the Bible than you would ever think is the matter of human sexuality. In fact, the Gentile translators of the Old Testament as we read it today in our English language, well, they were refined urban Europeans. And they brought with them the reserved and the at times puritanical European Christian mindset, as well as a not so hidden disdain for all things Jewish. Therefore, so much of the sexual content that is inherent in God's word is masked, and it's just stepped right over. In our day, in the West especially, the handling of sex resides for the most part at two ends of a spectrum, and there's not much middle ground. It's either dealt with in a sterile, purely pragmatic, scientific, or medical way, or as something so intensely sensitive and private that it's uncomfortable. And most good Christians really want to simply work our way around the subject when we hit it, especially in the Bible. We just don't even want our eyes to lay on it. Lately, of course, we have seen the progressive secular movement to normalize that which has historically and biblically been viewed as deviant or aberrant sexual practices. How are any of us going to know what is right and wrong when it comes to human sexuality if we don't look it up in the Bible, if we don't read about it, and not just go around it? Because I'll tell you, in this world today, you have commentators and even some hired religious guns for some of our newspapers that flat out lie to you about what's in the Bible and what's not about human sexuality. In our day, the biblical reality is that ancient cultures viewed sexuality quite different than we do. It was just a part of everyday life. It wasn't hidden. And because having large families was critical to the survival of the clan and tribe, everything that surrounded human reproduction was open and public, subject to the children being able to understand it at the earliest age. Because virtually every Hebrew family lived quite literally among the domesticated farm animals. So the function of sex was constantly visible, it was understood. People were not squeamish about it. Now don't get me wrong. People of that era were generally far more modest about their human sexuality in public than we are today. On the other hand, particularly as concerned large families living in one-room huts, or as nomads crammed together in cloth and animal skin tents, privacy was at a premium, and rarely was complete privacy possible. Human sexuality and its role in Hebrew society was therefore woven into their language and into their culture. It pervades the Old Testament from beginning to end. It's often used to present much larger spiritual pictures and principles. But at the same time, it's largely hidden from our view in the scriptures due to both the idiomatic expressions we read that are actually about sex. We just don't recognize it. And the rather blatant attempt by European Bible translators to simply hide it because they found it offensive. Now, I want you to understand that what we're going to be studying has nothing to do with sex education as it's come to be known in our public school system. That's not what we're going to do. Instead, it has to do with God's creation of mankind and the holy and sacred nature of God's defined roles for males and for females. It also has to do with certain duties that one sex has to the other. The concept of lawful and unlawful unions, how the underlying principles of human sexuality play out in both a physical and a spiritual way in a much wider context than we typically think about it, because it's almost not recognizable in our English Bibles. So let's open up our Bibles and our minds to God's mind and His purposes for ordering human life as He has. Let's read Deuteronomy chapter 22 together. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 221. You are not to watch your brother's ox or sheep straying and behave as if you hadn't seen it. You must bring it back to your brother. If your brother is not close by or you don't know who the owner is, you are to bring it home to your house, and it will remain with you until your brother asks for it. Then you're to give it back to him. You are to do the same with his donkey, his coat, or anything else of your brother's that he loses. If you find something lost, you must not ignore it. If you see your brother's donkey or ox collapsed on the road, you may not behave as if you hadn't seen it. You have to help him get it on its feet again. A woman is not to wear men's clothing. A man is not to put on woman's clothing. For whoever does these things is detestable to Adonai, our God. If, as you're walking along, you happen to see a bird's nest in a tree or on the ground with chicks or eggs, and the mother bird is sitting on the chicks or the eggs, you're not to take the mother with the chicks. You must let the mother go, but you may take the chicks for yourself. This is so that things will go well with you and you will prolong your life. When you build a new house, you must build a low wall around your roof. Otherwise, somebody may fall from it, and you will be responsible for his death. You're not to sow two kinds of seed between your rows of vines. If you do, both the two harvested crops and the yield from the vines must be forfeited. You are not to plow with an ox and a donkey together. You are not to wear clothing woven with two kinds of thread, wool, or linen together. You are to make for yourself twisted cords on the four corners of the garment you wrap around yourself. If a man marries a woman, has sexual relations with her, and then, having come to dislike her, brings false charges against her, defames her character by saying, "I married this woman, but when I had intercourse with her, I did not find evidence she was a virgin," then the girl's father and mother are to take the evidence of the girl's virginity to the leaders of the town at the gate. The girl's father will say to the leaders, "I let my daughter marry this man, but he hates her. So he's brought false charges that he didn't find evidence of her virginity there. Yet here is the evidence of my daughter's virginity," and they will lay the cloth before the town leaders. The leaders of that town are to take that man and punish him and fine him 2.5 pounds of silver shekels, which they will give to the girl's father because he has publicly defamed a virgin of Israel. She will remain his wife. He is forbidden from divorcing her as long as he lives. But if the charge is substantiated, that evidence for the girl's virginity could not be found, then they are to lead the girl to the door of her father's house, and the men of her town will stone her to death because she has committed in Israel the disgraceful act of being a prostitute while still in her father's house. In this way, you will put an end to such wickedness among you. If a man is found sleeping with a woman who has a husband, both of them must die. The man who went to bed with the woman and the woman too. In this way, you'll expel wickedness from Israel. If a girl who is a virgin is engaged to a man, and another man comes upon her in the town and has relations with her, you're to bring them both out to the gate of the city and stone them to death. The girl, because she didn't cry out for help there in the city, and the man, because he has humiliated his neighbor's wife. In this way, you will put an end to such wickedness among you. But if the man comes upon the girl out in the countryside, and the man grabs her and has relations with her, then only the man who had intercourse with her is to die. You should do nothing to the girl, because she's done nothing to deserve death. The situation is like the case of the man who attacks his neighbor and kills him. For he found her in the countryside, and the engaged girl cried out, but there was no one to save her. If a man comes upon a girl who is a virgin, but who is not engaged, and he grabs her and has sexual relations with her, and they are caught in the act, then the man who had intercourse with her must give to the girl's father 1.25 pounds of silver shekels, and she will become his wife because he humiliated her. He may not divorce her as long as he lives. The first five verses of Deuteronomy 22 present us with something that James, brother of Jesus, had much to say about. True religion. True religion. He began by saying the true religion is best illustrated in taking care of widows and orphans. In Hebrew society, widows and orphans represented the socially disadvantaged of that era. Those who were the weakest, they were the most vulnerable. Further, practicing true religion kept one unstained by the ways of the world. James and Paul and Yeshua explained that true religion is not about a mechanical obedience to laws and commandments. It's not. Rather, it is the spirit one adopts when following those laws. That's what matters. It is obedience to those laws accomplished within the context of love and trust of the lawgiver that produces the kind of righteousness that Yehovah is seeking from his worshipers. We have a legal saying in America whereby we are always worried about the risk of separating the letter of the law from the spirit of the law. When one seeks justice according only to the letter, but without the required spirit, then love, mercy, and justice can all be lost. If that is true in our man-made justice system, it is far more so in the God-ordained Torah justice system. Therefore, especially as regards these first five verses of Deuteronomy 22, the instructions all revolve around the attitude of the worshiper. Here we don't see the typical formula of the law of criminality that we're more used to seeing in the Torah. We don't see, if you do this, then this is what's going to happen to you. And to return to peace with God, you have to atone by means of thus and so kind of a sacrifice. Instead, these laws are done in the spirit of what Messiah says is the basis for all Torah commandments and laws. Love the Lord your God with all your being and love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor is not a rule or a regulation. It's not a law that has some kind of a direct consequence for its violation. It is a call to all who call God their Lord to the kind of a holy mindset It is a reminder that striving for holiness is the goal of the law, and that this kind of holiness is expressed on earth in this age of human history by loving your neighbor as yourself. The first illustration of how to love your neighbor as yourself in a practical application regards what happens if your brother's ox or sheep goes astray and you happen to stumble across those animals. Notice the use of the term brother in describing whom it is that's being defined as one's neighbor. In Hebrew, the word is ach, ach, and it is technically referring to a kinsman. In the sense of it as meant here, it means a member of your clan or your tribe. And in a broader sense, a member of your nation, Israel. Later on, Yeshua would go on to explain that in the Lord's eyes, your brother extends to anyone in need, and used the example of the Good Samaritan to demonstrate his point. However, in the strictest sense, this passage could easily read, you are not to watch a fellow Israelite's ox or sheep stray off. That's what it really meant. And the Lord says that when you witness a brother's, an Israelite's, domestic animal straying, you don't have the option of taking no action. You just can't turn your back on what you know is a circumstance that demands your help, even though this help isn't of any personal benefit to you. The concept is that indifference to the need of another human being, especially your ach, your brother, your fellow, is unaccepted to Yehovah. Indifference to the need of another is the opposite of love your neighbor. This law is actually given in its first form back in Exodus 23:4. If you come upon your enemy's ox or donkey straying, you must return it to him. So these verses of Deuteronomy 22 now elaborate on that basic law given back in Exodus 23. Recall that I've mentioned on numerous occasions, Deuteronomy is a sermon by Moses. And this sermon is a predecessor and it is a pattern that Yeshua would follow on his own Sermon on the Mount. This sermon of Moses generally is in the form of taking a basic law from Exodus and Leviticus and then expounding upon it, and then adding in life applications as examples of how one should apply a law. Therefore, in verse 2 is the complicating situation of what to do if your brother is nowhere around to claim the stray animal, or if he doesn't even live close by, or if you have no idea who owns the beast. Indifference is still not an option, nor is it acceptable to go by the philosophy that we all learned as children, the one I liked the best, finders, keepers, losers, weepers. Rather, one must capture the animal, take it home, care for it as though it's your own, wait for the owner to claim it, and then graciously give it back to him. Interestingly, the phrase about bringing the animal home literally instructs, literally, bring it inside your house. So if you find that pit bull, and that is exactly what is meant, because in that era, and in many parts of the Middle East to this very day, a person's house was built around a courtyard, an outdoor courtyard, or the home was two levels. Animals and humans together inhabited the first floor and the courtyard. Animals were valuable, so they had to be protected from predators and from thieves and from inclement weather just as much as family members did. Moses, who was a leader of 3 million people, would have learned to be quite the psychologist, I think, during his 40 years as their leader, because he knew that this was not enough information and that the search for loopholes would begin immediately. So he goes on to explain that this attitude concerning someone's lost property is not just limited to an ox or a sheep. It pertains to a donkey or a coat or anything else that you find that you know belongs to somebody else. Please notice something else that's emphasized here that we've touched on in a number of occasions, the seed of Abraham. Loving your neighbor isn't having an emotional concern or a warm feeling towards your neighbor. It's jumping in to help your neighbor in his time of need. Next in verse 4 is a regulation that is related to the one just before it. If you see your brother's beast of burden collapse under the weight of its load, you're to assist the animal. The previous regulation is about concern for the well-being of your brother. This one is about concern for the well-being of your brother's animal. In neither case is ignoring the situation the proper attitude of a worshiper of the God of Israel. The next law in verse 5 is one that's caused a lot of debate. Some of the debate is frankly hollow academic nonsense, and other of it helps to bring clarity. The words explain that a man is not to wear things that a woman normally would, and vice versa. Now, most translations say that this is referring to clothing. In fact, the more accurate translation is not clothing, but the more broad, things pertaining to being a man or being a woman. Therefore, particularly in regards to that era, it could mean weapons of war, or jewelry, or hairstyles, of course, garments. For sure, transvestism is at the center of this. And for those of you who have led more sheltered lives than others, in our day, a transvestite is a person who wears the clothing of the opposite sex. Men wearing women's clothes, women wearing men's clothes. But that is only how we see it today. More correctly, it's referring to a person of one sex taking on the characteristics of the opposite sex, whether it's appearance, roles, or clothing. This is not talking about sex change operations per se. Rather, it's about confusion and deception. It's about pretending to be or identifying yourself as the sex you're not. Now, the hollow academic nonsense I spoke of centers around a raging debate over why God doesn't want one sex pretending to be the other one. The reality is that the underlying reason for even having this debate is that progressive and liberal scholars would like to prove that God no longer sees these sorts of deviant behaviors that the Bible says, as it does here, are aberrant before the Lord, as still valid for us. Just as it has become so prevalent in the church that homosexuality should no longer be seen as a sin, so these particular scholars want to say that such behavior as transvestism was strictly confined to a certain era, in a certain culture. Besides, Christ's new law of love means that any behavior that's personal and doesn't seem to harm anybody else is okay. Or that the comment made by Paul in Galatians 3 that under Yeshua there is no male and no female means that God has voided the entire concept of sexuality. Oh yes, that's taught in many places, that that's what that means. Let me assure you That comment in Galatians simply meant that the spiritual status of a human being before the Lord, whether that person, a person was acceptable or unacceptable to him, depended on his or her relationship with Messiah, not on whether that person was a male or a female. On the other side of the coin, it's interesting to see from a practical point of view where the idea first played a role in ancient societies. We have historical records that among the Mesopotamian cultures, it was customary for a male priest to don certain female garments or to wear expressly female jewelry or even to be painted using female cosmetics when the deity he was worshiping was a goddess. The idea was to disguise himself as a female to identify with the feminine attributes of the female god. Another well-attested circumstance of ancient times was of men who would dress like women and hide in plain sight in hopes they wouldn't be drafted into the military. Conversely, we've had women who cut their hair short, wore men's clothing and armor, used man-sized weapons in hopes of being taken for a man so they could go off and fight battles. Now, I have no doubt that this law of verse 5 covers these sorts of things and might have even been used quite often to directly counter men and women who attempted them. But the real purpose was more broad and deep than simply these examples that I've given to you. And some of that is clear when we see the context of the laws that surround this one in Deuteronomy 22. Once again, this law speaks against transvestism and is speaking to the attitude and the condition of the worshiper's heart. It speaks to the spirit of obeying God's laws and staying true to the way He ordered the universe. Here, at least partly, it speaks to deception and confusion, which is always considered bad in the Lord's economy. It also speaks of homosexuality that is a matter of attitude and moral choice. And we're going to look at another aspect of this outlawed sexual behavior later on. Well, these laws of true religion, which refers to the worshiper operating within the spirit of the law, continues with the admonition of verse 6, which prohibits the capture of a mother bird along with her chicks. There are two main points to this law. The first is that it extends the humanitarian security blanket of concern for domestic animals that we saw under the regulation about helping an ox or donkey that's collapsed alongside the road. It takes it now to wild animals. In this case, to a bird, wild bird. And part of the reason this needs to be stated is that a wild bird has little or no value when compared to the sizable economic value of a sheep or a donkey or an ox. Therefore, the Lord is demonstrating that the principle of humanitarianism extends to all of God's creatures. And their economic value is to be held as secondary. Even more, just as James says, the true religion is demonstrated in caring for the most vulnerable and least valuable of human society. This same principle applies to the most vulnerable and least valuable of the animal kingdom. The second point is that the reverence to a parent-child relationship doesn't end with humans. Rabbis often use this explanation as the reason for the strange law of Deuteronomy 14:2 that says a kid, meaning a baby goat, is not to be boiled in its mother's milk. Now, we can be sure of the link between the mother bird and her children, and humans and our children, because the author of Deuteronomy structured his narrative in a way that connects the two together in a familiar form. Recall the fifth commandment of Exodus 20:12. honor your father and mother so that you may live long in the land which Adonai your God's giving you. Here in Deuteronomy 22, it's 7, it says, you must let the mother go, but take the chicks for yourself so that things will go well for you and you will prolong your life. It's basically the same thought in the same language as the fifth commandment, that by showing proper respect to the value of the parent and their relationship with their offspring, sparing the life of the mother bird, you will live long and things will go well with you. In other words, you'll experience God's shalom as a blessing. Now, the subject of an Israelite's requirement to be humanitarian in attitude and action takes on now another light, and the requirement to build what we would call today a parapet around the roof of one's home. Now, obviously, think about when this is being told. They're still on the Exodus journey. This is looking forward to a time that was a few months away, when Joshua would lead Israel to conquer Canaan. The Israelites would put away their tents and start living in permanent housing. A parapet is essentially a balcony railing that goes around the edge of a home, around the roof, around the, of a home. And its purpose is so somebody doesn't accidentally fall off. And the typical Middle Eastern home of that era was built using a flat roof. And a roof was essentially just another living area of the house to be utilized like the one below it. Stairs or ladders were built so that the roof was accessible. On the roof, drying and storing produce and fish would occur, as would socializing on a pleasant day or even sleeping on it during the furnace-like summer months. Therefore, it was only common sense that a fence was built around the roof's edge so that a person wouldn't fall off and then be seriously hurt or maybe even killed. This is verified because the end of verse 8 declares that the spiritual reason this precaution is necessary is that the danger was sufficient enough that to not build that parapet constituted criminal negligence. In other words, one could reasonably expect that eventually somebody was going to fall off that roof. And death as the result of such wanton disregard for the welfare of others, well, that would bring blood guilt upon that home's owner, upon the whole family that lived there, and the community whose government didn't enforce the building code that he had to put a parapet around his roof. This was an unjust death, and the life of the responsible party could be required. In other words, you could be executed for this. Now, this ends the pretty easy and straightforward part of Deuteronomy 22. From here on, it gets complicated and not just a little bit dicey. The next few verses gives us three laws on what's commonly called illicit mixtures. We've already been given one illicit mixture, but it was spoken of in a different context. Transvestism. Illicit means it's not authorized. It's not approved. It is a gross misuse of something. So the idea of these three forbidden mixtures we'll be discussing, plus the one concerning transvestites, is that these are combinations that create unions that shouldn't ever be permitted. These various unions fly in the face of God's order of creation, and they're a severe form of rebellion. It's not just the action of it that's the issue. It's the blasphemous attitude of the violator that's the crux of this whole matter. The first of this group is found in verse 9. It is that a farmer is not to sow two kinds of seed in the area of soil that's located between the rows of grapevines in his vineyard. The second is verse 10. An ox and a donkey shouldn't be yoked together to pull a plow. And the third is verse 11. One's not to wear clothing made of two distinct kinds of thread that have been woven together. And those two threads are wool and linen. These three laws are repeats and extensions taken from Leviticus 19:19, which says, observe my regulations. Don't let your livestock mate with those of another kind. Don't sow your field with two different kinds of grain. Don't wear a garment made with two different kinds of thread. So any kind of mixture or union that is against law, God's law, is called kilayim in Hebrew, which translates literally to of more than one kind. So seriously did the Hebrews regard violation of these laws. They dedicated an entire tractate of the Talmud to it. Its name, Kilayim. Yet as serious as of a matter as they knew this to be, just why God prohibited cross-dressing? Why did he prohibit two kinds of seeds being planted together, wearing a garment made of two different kinds of material, an ox and a donkey yoked together to the same plow? All this was a mystery, even to the greatest rabbis. Rashi explains all these as simply a sovereign decree of God, for which there is no reason given. And it need not be. And while I understand Rashi's great humility in this matter, in declining to delve into the why of these laws, which I fully agree with, I think we might be able to add at least some grist to the mill. So clear your heads and get ready to see some amazing connections grow right in front of your eyes. To begin with, each of these four laws on illicit mixtures are associated with the seventh commandment, the law against adultery. I want to repeat something I've said over and over, but I want it to sink in deep. The structure of the law in the Bible works like this. All the hundreds of laws and commandments are based upon the Ten Commandments. Every law you will find, including what we're reading now, connects right back to a very specific one of the Ten Commandments. Every one. Because what they are is case laws and examples of how to carry out each one of the Ten Commandments. But then, all the Ten Commandments, as we're told by Messiah, goes right back to the two foundational axioms of the universe. Love your God with all your heart, mind, and being, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's the hierarchy. That's how it's built. You see what I'm getting at? That's how it works. So, we're dealing now with the seventh commandment. That's what this law is dealing with. The seventh commandment, the law against adultery. Notice that from a purely practical, rational standpoint, none of these laws of mixtures causes serious harm to anyone or anything. You want to know something? In fact, there could even be great benefit in a physical sense from doing some of the very things that are prohibited. For instance, it's long been known and practiced that planting two different types of seeds, meaning plants, crops, together can bring all kinds of good results on a physical level. This is called intercropping. And it's been employed especially in areas where farming is done more primitively. Sometimes one kind of plant attracts a type of insect that can be beneficial to both kinds of plants. Maybe, say, for pollination. In other instances, one kind of plant produces a needed nutrient that the other one takes from the soil, thus slowing the depletion of the soil. On another level, one can make maximum use of the arable land by planting two kinds of crops in the same space that are symbiotic. And so they provide maximum food production using minimal amount of land. It can even protect against crop failure, starvation, by growing two different kinds of plants that are each susceptible to different kinds of hazards. They're more tolerant to one kind of thing or another. So the case of Deuteronomy 22:9, of not planting a crop of a different kind among the vineyards, is such that grapevines have to be planted in rows that are spaced well apart so they can thrive. So what good purpose is possibly served to let the significant amount of ground in between those rows go to waste? Goodness, if that precious water that's used to water the vines can be doubly used to water vegetables or grain that grows on the ground beneath those vines, isn't that being a good shepherd over limited environmental resources? Tough question. It's also a reality from a physical perspective that weaving fine linen and wool together produces a high quality cloth. It's beautiful, it's durable. Why is that bad in God's eyes? It was nearly impossible in the minds of the great Hebrew sages to find any earthly fault, any inherent evil in wearing that kind of a material. Yet, there sits that law prohibiting it. And it can't be seen as a mistake or a misinterpretation. It's explicit. It's straightforward. Therefore, the prohibition was strictly mandated, strictly observed by most of the pious Jews right up till today. Is there really any harm in yoking an ox and a donkey together to plow? No. Despite all the efforts of teachers and preachers to explain that the plow would always be turning off to one direction of the weaker animal or the stronger animal or would harm the weaker one or that it would be all inefficient, in real life, this just is not so. In fact, such a thing of having two different kinds of animals pull a plow or a wagon together was very common in the ancient world because a man would be very fortunate to own one ox along with one donkey. An ox was better at pulling something than carrying it, but it could carry things. A donkey was better designed to carry things than to pull things, but it could do either. When a plow needed the horsepower that it took two animals to provide, the ancients saw nothing wrong with those two animals being perhaps a donkey and an ox working together. And from an earthly sense, there's no lasting harm that comes to either of those beasts of burden just because they're not exactly equal in strength or size. I give great credit to the rabbis who have at least been much more forthcoming about their lack of understanding of the why of these laws rather than creating the great allegorical explanations that have pervaded Christianity and tends to lead us down highly questionable paths. At the same time, it's always been the tendency of the rabbis to see the earthly, physical side of God's laws and prophecies rather than their heavenly, spiritual side. So let's see if we can look at this then from a little bit different angle. Suffice it to say, it is obvious that these laws of illicit mixture cannot have been ordained by God in order that by doing so, certain animals and plants or humans would benefit from it from a physical standpoint. It is equally obvious that there's nothing inherently evil by planting two different kinds of seeds in close proximity. Wickedness doesn't spontaneously erupt when linen thread is mixed with wool. I've not seen it. And it's not devilishly inhumane to attach a donkey and an ox to the same plow yoke. So this reality shouldn't surprise us. I've discussed with you that every attempt by biblical scholars to explain why certain animals were designated by God as ritually clean, while others were ritually unclean, it's frustrated them all. Every time they come up with a rational, logical, scientific system, something else in the scriptures just shoots that right down. Why are certain foods kosher and others aren't? Why is it okay to sacrifice a goat but you can't sacrifice a pig? What's wrong with that? Why can a bull be offered to God but you can't offer a camel? Pretty big, expensive animal. What about not having a cloven an animal having a cloven hoof or not chewing a cud makes that animal not suitable for purposes of holiness. As Rashi says about the four laws of illicit mixture, God is sovereign. He decreed it. It's not necessary that we know why in order to observe the law. In fact, I maintain that the search for why in the Bible is a boondoggle of major proportions on most accounts. The issue for followers of God ought never to be why, but rather which. Which pattern or law should be applied to any given circumstances is what ought to matter. Not why did God ordain that law, because what is that a search for? Should I do it or shouldn't I? If I can't understand it, I don't know God's mind, that I don't feel obligated. I further maintain that, like the kosher food laws and the laws of animals deemed suitable for sacrifice, these laws of illicit mixture illustrate in a physical, visible way some immutable spiritual principles. It's the illustration and what is learned from them that's the point. It's not that the actions or the materials or the creatures themselves that are the principle. It's what it's demonstrating that is the principle. Next week, we're going to continue looking at some connections in the scriptures, both Old Testament and New, that intertwine illicit mixtures, sexuality, and adultery. I think it's going to open your eyes about some things.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.